Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Economists are doing some plastic surgery, giving an important benchmark a facelift. A priest's plot to steal millions, and we'll take a look back at the week that was. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast. It's Friday, the 28th of June, and it's great to have you with us. Next month, the U.S. economy is going to look a lot bigger, not because it's growing any faster, but because economists are going to measure it differently. Right now, gross domestic product, GDP, doesn't include intellectual property, royalties from movies and music. Soon, that's going to change, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
You really want to stump an economist? Ask him what his favorite movie is.
You're asking tough questions here.
That's Brent Moulton. He's an economist at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which measures the U.S. economy. I never did find out what his favorite movie is, but he did tell me the most recent movie he saw, Monsters University.
Just wait, Hotshot. I'm going to scare circles around you this year.
There's a reason I was asking Moulton those tough movie questions. The Bureau is giving a much-needed Hollywood facelift to the way it measures economic output, and Moulton is the surgeon. Right now, the Bureau only counts tangible products when measuring GDP, things like cars and washing machines. Sales of movie tickets, songs, and books counted, but Moulton says the Bureau didn't measure research and development costs.
That would include things like salaries paid to actors or people doing special effects.
The Bureau is going to unveil its facelift on July 31st with a slew of new numbers. The economy is going to look a lot bigger, according to economist Joel Prakken of Macroeconomic Advisors.
There will be an upward revision in the level of GDP that's several hundreds of billions of dollars.
But remember, the economy isn't growing any faster. We're just measuring more of it. Dan Sickle teaches economics at Wellesley.
It's as if we had not counted Alabama as part of the economy, and then suddenly one day we realize we should start counting Alabama.
And why didn't we start counting everything sooner? It's complicated. It's taken the Bureau of Economic Analysis 10 years to come up with its new accounting model. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
It was a busy news week, and there was no shortage of business news. The markets were still digesting what Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had to say a couple of weeks ago. The Supreme Court delivered some big decisions, and an immigration bill cleared the Senate. Joining us live for a little analysis is Heidi Moore from The Guardian. She's at our bureau in New York, and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal in our D.C. bureau. Hey, guys.
Hey, David.
Hey, David.
Good to talk to you. So, Heidi, let's start with the markets. The deconstruction of what Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had to say or what he didn't say a couple of weeks ago continues. What's been going on?
Well, basically, Ben Bernanke indicated that at some point the Fed will stop giving welfare to the markets. And all of these proud capitalists freaked out and panicked. And the thing is, it actually has real world consequences for normal people. So because the markets are thinking ahead 2 years to when interest rates are going to rise, right now, your mortgage rates have gone up by, from 3.88% in November to 4.6%.
The horror, 4.46%. Sudeep, talk to me a bit about this. I mean, what's this mean? Are we reaching the end here of what was sort of a period of historically low rates?
We certainly are reaching that period. I think the lowest point has passed. We're probably going to still stay pretty low compared to where we've been over the last couple of decades. But this is an important turning point in the recovery. Next week, the U.S. recovery moves into its fifth year, and we are still worrying about Fed stimulus and whether we're going to be able to get by without these extraordinary actions by the central bank. Some people call it monetary cocaine. Some people say it's really needed stimulus, but it's going to be a very rocky year as we come out of this and try to just adjust to the idea of the Fed not being there backing us up.
Right. I mean, Heidi, at some point that cocaine's going to be gone. What's going to happen?
Well, it's going to be exactly what you expect. It's going to the markets are going to need rehab. It's going to be a huge crash. And the question is it going to be a long, slow crash or a quick and brutal crash? But the markets have really gotten used to being subsidized by the Federal Reserve. And all of those investors that bought all of those bonds because they thought the Fed was behind them are now going to have to put their money somewhere else. And it's going to hurt.
It's been a couple of years now, I think, since MF Global collapsed. That was the big brokerage firm. And finally, it seems, Heidi, we're seeing a bit of accountability or the threat of some accountability.
I know. It's the threat of accountability. Finally, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is the regulator of derivatives and of MF Global, decided to press charges against John Corzine, who ran the company and who also most people would know as the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. There's some evidence, obviously we'll see as it goes on, but there's some evidence that he may have known about MF Global's troubles before it fell apart. And if so, I think it'll be the first real example of a high-profile person who's been brought to account.
Yeah, Sudeep, did they sort of have to do this? Did the CFTC sort of face a lot of pressure to hold someone to account?
They really do. Regulators have a credibility problem. Wall Street obviously has a credibility problem. We've gone through a financial crisis, and all these years later, we're still wondering whether people who made some of the most important decisions are being held to account. And ultimately, this comes down to creating some sense of confidence in the industry and the ability of Washington to watch over the industry before we'll really be able to heal the wounds from the financial crisis.
Sudeep, you're there in Washington. We had a big week, obviously, and one facet of it was that the Senate passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And, of course, there are business implications that come with that, that maybe E-Verify, maybe more security along the border. Talk to me a bit about that.
Well, if you look back at several hundred years of history of our country, many of the most important overhauls of immigration have been tied to economic concerns. Businesses have been pushing their issues, and in this case, they're pushing issues on both ends of the skill spectrum. They want higher skilled workers to be able to drive a tech industry, and they want lower skilled workers to be able to do some lower paying jobs that people might not be willing to take. And so whether this gets through the House is a big question, but it's going to be driven in large part by the power of business to rally around something like this and make it happen.
The Wall Street Journal's Sudeep Reddy in our D.C. Bureau. Thanks, Sudeep.
Thanks, David.
And Heidi Moore with The Guardian in New York. Thanks, Heidi. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, David.
Every week, our wrappers send us a list of their long reads, stuff we can catch up on over the weekend. And there's some good stuff there. You can find it at our website, marketplace.org. On Wall Street Today, we've got the sad music queued up, ready to go. Details when we do the numbers. Ninety-nine years ago today, on June 28, 1914, something happened in Sarajevo that sent shockwaves around the world. The Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, and that led to the First World War, a war in which some 9 million soldiers lost their lives. In the UK, plans are already underway for the 100th anniversary, and the British government has been taking flak over its plans for the centenary, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Britain may be bogged down in a big austerity drive, but it's still going to spend $75 million on the commemorations. Prime Minister David Cameron says the centenary is too important to ignore.
There is something about the First World War that makes it a fundamental part of our national consciousness. Put simply, this matters not just in our heads, but in our hearts.
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war!
But will the centenary programme just pander to a popular perception reinforced by the musical Oh, What a Lovely War and the TV comedy Blackadder that in World War I Britain just stumbled from one insane blunder to another?
A brilliant new tactical plan to ensure final victory in the field.
Would this brilliant plan involve us climbing out of our trenches and walking very slowly towards the enemy, sir?
Some military historians claim that, like Blackadder, Britain's centenary plans focus too much on British defeats, on the carnage, on what many see as the conflict's utter futility.
The First World War was certainly tragic, but it was not futile. It was a war of national survival, and it became a war of liberation.
Military historian Professor Gary Sheffield. He's worried the centenary will play down the most important fact about the war from the point of view of Britain and its allies. They won it.
We need to recognise what a huge national achievement it was for the country to come through the war victorious.
Sheffield says Britain and its allies were defending themselves against German aggression. Max Hastings is author of a new book about World War I called Catastrophe 1914. He's also critical of Britain's centenary planners.
Their view seems to be to just regard this as an occasion for hand-wringing and say, oh God, wasn't it all awful and we were all to blame, not wanting to upset today's Germans.
A senior government minister has said, we don't want this to turn into an anti-German festival. We'd rather take a non-judgmental approach. But that, says Hastings, is an insult to modern Germany, which has fully faced up to its militaristic past. Britain's centenary events need not be triumphalist, he says, but they must be truthful.
If it's just going to be another occasion for saying, oh God, and singing, oh, what a lovely war, well, it will all be an awful waste of money and time and political attention.
Says Britain's commemoration should at least acknowledge that British soldiers died in a cause worth fighting for. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, you ever notice how in the movies every family has a nice house and a white picket fence?
We don't live in the country we think we live in. The world that is projected as middle class in the media is in fact a world that no more than 15% of America can afford.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some volatility on this final trading day of the quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 114 points, 0.75%, to end at 14,909. The NASDAQ gained 1 point, which is basically flat, to settle at 3403, and the S&P 500 edged down 6 points, 0.4%, to finish at 1606. For the week, the Dow rose 0.7%, the NASDAQ climbed 1.4%, and the S&P 500 added 0.8%. Research in Motion unplugged 26% after the company that makes the BlackBerry came out with surprisingly weak and vague profit forecasts. The technology services firm Accenture dropped 10% because of lower revenue projections for the rest of the year. Competitor IBM erased 2.33%. It wasn't all bad for tech stocks. Oracle charged up 0.8%. Intel and Apple both sweetened by 0.7%. And Google added 0.3%. Morgan Stanley fell 2.5%. Bank of America unloaded 1.1%. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase each gave back 0.6%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note ticked up to 2.49%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at Netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for May. Otherwise, things are pretty quiet in the nation's capital. Congress is on break. President Obama continues his travels across Africa. And some people observe Cell Phone Courtesy Month. I anticipate a shortage of participants. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. A Monsignor is behind bars today along with an Italian Secret Service agent and a financier. They're accused of plotting to smuggle tens of millions of euros from a Swiss bank into Italy on a private jet. You can't make this stuff up. And so the Vatican Bank is the subject of another scandal. Just this week, Pope Francis announced an investigation into corruption there. Jason Berry is the author of Render Unto Rome, a book about church finances. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
All right. So this thing reads like a caper. You've got a Monsignor who teams up with two guys named Giovanni, a Secret Service agent, and a broker.
Well, it's a very strange story, to say the least. You know, he's accused of trying to smuggle 20 million euros from Switzerland into Italy. He was a mid-level staffer at the Vatican Bank. And I think one of the great questions now being raised is not only why he was in a position to do this, but also he did it with allegedly the help of an Italian Secret Service agent who was paid a commission for his help. So it, I think, sadly demonstrates that the bank is still not under a sort of workable control.
Tell me about this money. Where did this money come from?
If I knew that answer, I think I would probably be in negotiations with the Wall Street Journal right now.
What concrete steps has Pope Francis taken to bring more light, to shed more light on the Vatican Bank?
Well, he's done two things, one tangible, the other rhetorical. He has named new people to this oversight board. He also met today with Carl Anderson, a board member of the bank, who was the key person in getting rid of Tedeschi, the former head of the Vatican Bank, last year. So there's obviously a shakeup that is continuing. What is more intriguing to me is the language that this pope is using. In May, he called for a global rethinking of the entire system, seeking ways to reform and correct it in a manner consistent with fundamental human rights. This is far beyond the language that Benedict XVI had used. So he comes to this position with a very strong conviction about the need to remedy poverty. And I would say he's on a very fast learning curve about how deeply compromised the Vatican Bank is.
So tell me quickly, sort of what's next for the Monsignor? Where do things stand? Where are they headed?
Well, I would assume he would be prosecuted by the Italian state. The more interesting question is what happens to the Secret Service agent who was being paid, who had been paid 200,000 euro to assist him and was waiting for a second installment of the same amount. You know, this has got to be embarrassing for the Italian government as well. I mean, it's a huge black eye for the Holy See, but you've got the Italian Secret Service in bed with the Vatican Bank at the very time that the European banking regulators are expecting, demanding that the Holy See open up its books and change its banking practices. So it's rather a double-edged sword.
Jason Barry covers religion for Global Post. He's also the author of Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. Jason, thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This week, we got word that sales of new homes rose to the highest level in 5 years. That's more good news for the housing recovery. Prices are climbing. Lots of cash buyers are out there, and inventory is low. It's a seller's market, but without a lot of sellers. The market's been so tough for so long, it seems many homeowners aren't anxious to move. Commentator Andrea Gardner thinks she knows why.
Until recently, my only experience in the real estate market has been as a loser. In 2007, my husband and I bought a tiny condo for way too much. Within months, the market tanked and our mortgage went scuba diving. Then we had two babies in 2 years. Picture my condo deflating, shrinking in both size and value. There was a lot of crying in that shoebox, and it wasn't just the babies. I wanted out, but couldn't sell without a serious ding to my credit and my ego. Every news story about the economy, every dinner party conversation, every glance at Zillow left me cringing as I faked a brave face. At least I'm getting a great tax deduction. I got the pity face from many a playground mom, both the self-satisfied renters and those who bought in the 90s and still had equity in the wake of the crash. I'll be honest, I did consider the so-called strategic default, the parachute out of underwater claustrophobia, but I didn't default or short sell or foreclose. I vowed to wait it out. We would sell this place the moment we could break even. Well, that moment has arrived, but now I don't want to go. It's not that the condo isn't cramped anymore, it still is, but equity changes things. I'm starting to like the place again. It's amazing how the little annoyances of your home fade away once you're gaining thousands of dollars in value every month. those dinner party conversations have changed. When my renter friends looking to buy talk about getting killed in taxes or not being able to get a loan or getting bid out by cash buyers, I'm standing there all smug like, yeah, I don't know, I already own. It's 2013, baby. I'm feeling like a winner. And I think I deserve this. I dug in my heels and weathered a 1,000-square-foot condo with two toddlers underfoot. I'm tough. I learned about timing the hard way. And I'm not leaving this blackjack table just as it's getting hot.
Andrea Gardner is a teacher and a writer who lives in Pasadena, California. We talk a lot on this show about how important the middle class is to the U.S. economy. Middle-class Americans drive consumer spending. They're responsible for 70% of economic growth. Well, as the gap between rich and poor changes, so do our notions about our sense of what it means to be middle class. Our wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark's noticed how those changes are reflected, sometimes even shaped by popular culture. Chrissy's going to take us through some of Hollywood's most interesting depictions of the middle class.
Once upon a time, in the 1950s, America was still working out just what the middle class was. Up until then, we talked more about two different ends of what we now call the middle class. Wage earners, on the one hand, and salary men, on the other. And that was reflected in Hollywood.
Well, let's see now. That'll be $1.79. How's that with you, Miss Fazeri?
When Ernest Borgnine won his Oscar for Marty, he was playing a classic wage earner, a butcher.
Marty, I want a nice big fat bullet, about 4 pounds.
Sure.
And there were movies about salaried men, like Gregory Peck in The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. At the beginning of the movie, he had an office job in Manhattan making $7,000 a year, but his wife had aspirations.
You're not going to always be making $7,000.
I could be making less.
But you can't look at things like that, Tommy. You've got to believe that things are going to get better. Promotions, opportunities, some good breaks.
And she was right. In the 1950s, there were lots of good breaks across the economy. Upward mobility seemed really possible for everyone, so much so that the worlds of salaryman and wage earner began to merge. By the end of the decade, there was a sort of official declaration of this fact by the U.S. government.
It was the first week of July 1959 that the Labor Department released a report.
That's Kathleen Newman, a professor at Carnegie Mellon who studies mass media and society. And she's talking about a report called How American Buying Habits Change. Here's an excerpt.
Today, the wage earner's way of life is well nigh indistinguishable from that of his salaried co-citizens. Their homes, their cars, the style of the clothes their wives and children wear, the food they eat are alike and are becoming more nearly identical.
In other words,
guess what? We did it. Everyone's middle class. We can relax now.
And that's the story Hollywood started to reflect back to us. We stopped seeing many Marty the Butchers. We got lots of men in suits, from Ward Cleaver in Leave It to Beaver, all the way through Dr. Huxtable in The Cosby Show. He may have been famous for his colorful sweaters, but his job as a doctor put him squarely in the white-collar middle class. For a while, at least, Hollywood's version of the middle class made some sense. Wages for average workers were rising, and a blue-collar job could afford you a lot of the stuff a white-collar family had. But by the late 1970s, that trend was in reverse. And since then, the gap between the two ends of the middle class continues to widen, which reminds me of a funny story I heard recently.
Oh, I'm Rosemary Brandenburg. I'm a set decorator.
Rosemary's decorated sets for a bunch of films, including Castaway. Before Tom Hanks gets in that plane crash and has to survive on a desert island, there's a scene at his girlfriend's parents' house eating Christmas dinner.
The turkey's a little dry, isn't it?
And we were asked to make a typical middle-class dining room, living room, and I was too shy to go to our director and ask him which middle class he really wants.
And that's where Rosemary made a fatal mistake.
I made middle class in my life, which was old-fashioned granny lampshades and print couches and lazy boy chair, printed wallpaper.
A working class version of a typical middle class home. Well-loved, a little bit shabby. When Rosemary had the set ready, the director came to see.
He walked in and just hated it. Said, what have you done here? I mean, this looks like grandma's house. I think he had in mind somebody with much more upscale taste, up-to-date furnishings.
And so she redid the whole set, top to bottom. After this experience,
essentially, I never worked for him again.
But Rosemary says she also learned something very important.
One can't simply assume that middle class is middle class.
Hollywood's inflated version of the middle class is still alive and well today. Think about the TV show New Girl. A bunch of 20-somethings with teacher and bartender salaries live in a gorgeous loft in L.A. Or that movie from a couple years ago, It's Complicated, where Meryl Streep plays a baker and somehow lives in a mansion in Santa Barbara where the kitchen alone looks like it cost $1 million. Of course, Hollywood never pretended to be anything but pretend, and there's nothing wrong with dreaming. But consider this observation from Damon Silver, a labor lawyer for the AFL-CIO. When he watches this stuff, he thinks about how it shapes the collective image we have of ourselves.
There is a tendency to imagine that we live in a country where the typical family makes $150,000 a year. But half of all American households have incomes less than $55,000 a year. Half.
Just to emphasize that half of American families make less than $55,000 a year.
So there's kind of a cognitive problem here. We don't live in the country we think we live in. The world that is projected as middle class in the media is in fact a world that no more than 15% of America can afford.
And yet, a lot of us try to afford it, often by getting in a lot of debt. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, if you happen to have an Aaron Hernandez jersey lying around, it might be kind of awkward to wear that number 81 out in public these days now that Hernandez is accused of murder. Well, the New England Patriots announced today that you've got the chance to exchange your Hernandez jersey for another one, free of charge. It's a limited-time offer, though. You've got to do it this weekend. Also this weekend, our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, launches a new online game called Financial Feud, where you can argue over where to spend your money. Play along at marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 114 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ gained 1 point, basically flat, and the S&P 500 edged down 6 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. JJ Yor is the vice president and general manager. And I'm David Gura. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.